The point of concentration practice is to establish enough calmness of mind so that we can do insight practice. And the only way we're going to get to enlightenment is if we start being able to make a distinction between reality as we perceive it and reality as it exists. Because they're usually not the same. And it's very easy to be caught up in this little world that we run in. It's not so easy to get out of that and really start understanding how our mind works and how everything else works. You know, we hear this talk about impermanence and karma and emptiness and suffering, the nature of suffering. And we can read about it, and we can intellectualize about it, discuss it, but we're only really going to have an understanding of it is if we can really put our attention and our focus on it. And that's the point of concentration practice, is to quiet the mind in order to do that. And we're going to talk about two types of concentration practices, which seem to be the two most prevalent around. And one is called the jhanas, J-H-A-N-A-S, the jhanas, which are the meditation absorption practices. And if you were here Sunday, you heard a talk by Lee Brazington that I played, where he actually gave instructions on how to get into the first jhana. I'm not going to attempt to explain that tonight, nor am I going to attempt to really give any kind of understanding on how the other one works either. If I were doing a 45-minute talk, I might give it a shot, but we just don't have that much time. And I'm not sure I'd do that good a job anyway. But let me talk a little bit about jhanas, or the meditative absorptions, in that the student really focuses on developing concentration until they enter a stage called the jhanas. And it's been said that you don't really go for the jhanas. It's kind of like the jhanas come to you. In fact, if you try to strive for them, they're not going to happen. It just doesn't work that way. So the focus is really to use mindfulness of breath and establish that practice, focusing on the breath. And when Rania was doing the guided meditation, that's how, you know, after we sort of relaxed the body and so on, we established focus on the breath. And you do that practice, and once that has stabilized, then the mind is calm enough to start doing some insight practices. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. The other practice is called by many names. It's referred to as moment-to-moment concentration. It's been called momentary. It's called direct. It's called bare. It's called dry concentration. It goes by all these different names. And I'm going to refer to it as moment-to-moment concentration. And that's where the practitioner goes directly to a combination of concentration and vipassana. You're going right to the process of investigating your thoughts as you develop concentration. In the jhana practice, there's more like a stage. You establish concentration, it's very clear. And the instructions are, until you establish concentration, there's no point in trying to go into insight practice. Where in moment-to-moment concentration, they work more together. And we have people in this room who are much more experienced than I am at this. So I'm sure they'll correct me, and I hope they do if I say anything wrong when we get to the discussion. So what I want to do, though, is try to explain some of the similarities and some of the distinctions between the two, give a little bit of background on how they develop. But first, I want to go to what the Buddha said about concentration. Now, if you're building a case for the jhanas, and trust me, there are people on both sides of this discussion, and the point of this is not to get into a debate. Really, the point is that both are available to us. We can use whatever is most suitable to us, suitable for us. But Here's what the Buddha said. This comes from the Samyutta Nikaya, or the Connected Discourses. And he asked the question to the monks, because he was always talking to an assembly of monks. Well, sometimes there were kings and princes and other people, but there were always monks there. And he said, so what, monks, is right concentration? There is the case where a monk, quite secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful mental qualities, which are the hindrances, enters and remains in the first jhana, rapture and happiness born of seclusion, accompanied by initial and sustained thinking. With the stilling of initial and sustained thinking, he enters and remains in the second jhana, and so on and so on. I'm going to spare you. And he goes through the third jhana and the fourth jhana. Okay? Then he says at the end, this, monks, is right concentration. So what he's saying is, right concentration, you do the jhanas. Case closed, right? Well, maybe, maybe not. And there are numerous other references in the discourses, which are also known as the Pali Canon, numerous references to the jhanas. And the suttas indicate, the teachings indicate, that on the night of his enlightenment, the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and began his meditation by practicing the jhanas. It's in the book, right? Now, what's important to understand is that at the time the Buddha did this, the jhanas had been around a long time. The jhanas were very prevalent during that time. In fact, he had two main teachers during the years that he studied prior to reaching enlightenment, and they taught him the jhanas. The first one taught him the first seven, and the second taught him the eighth. And they were very common practice. In the suttas, there's very little instruction as to actually how to do the jhanas. And the probable reason for this is that the jhanas were so well established at that time that to give directions would be kind of like saying, all right, Will, let's see, you're coming over to my house tomorrow, right? We're going to work on something. Now, here's what you do. You go out, you get in your car, and you start it, okay? And put your seatbelt on, and let's see, automatic or stick?
It's a stick.
Stick. So you got to push the clutch in, then you got to put it in first, then you come out. I'm not going to tell him this. He knows how to drive. All I got to do is give him the directions, or maybe just the address, and he can use the GPS. So it was kind of like that with the jhanas. People knew how to do the jhanas, right? So that's probably, you know, why there aren't a lot of instructions. They've been taught for a long, long time. Now, another reason is the jhanas are really best learned one-on-one with a teacher. And they don't lend themselves very well to book learning. One similarity to both practices, to both the jhanas and moment-to-moment concentration, is that it's really important to practice the ethics, known as sila, S-I-L-A. In both cases, if we're not living an ethical life, we're probably not going to be very successful at establishing concentration. Now, the teacher that I practice the jhanas with, and some of the rest of you have, Lee Brazington, uses a great analogy. He says, let's face it, if we're out there robbing banks, we're probably going to be having a hard time being concentrated if we're worrying when they're going to catch up with us. And many of you have probably noticed that ethical practice is the foundation of virtually every legitimate spiritual practice that's out there. I mean, what are they in Christianity? The Ten Commandments, right? And it doesn't matter what you study. So you really need that as a foundation to stabilize the mind. So it establishes a solid ground to work on your concentration. So back to the jhanas. One of the things that's necessary in order to reach the jhanas is access concentration. And that's the point in the practice where, as we're doing mindfulness of breathing, where, you know, as we're doing mindfulness of breathing, thoughts arise, right? Unless you guys are way ahead of me. And then what we do is we usually note them, you know, and let them drift away. Okay, judgment. Let it go, come back to the breath, and so on. And we continue to do this. Well, many times we have different afflictions affecting our concentration, and they've been identified as the five hindrances. And number one, sense desires or lust, attachment, greed. The second is ill will, aversion, anger. All right? In other words, first one is I want it. Second is I don't want it. And all of us who've been on retreat know about that first one, because our stomach starts growling. We're thinking, geez, how far away am I from lunch? Or the second one, if we've been on retreat, or maybe just in this room, it's like, why is that person breathing so loud? Or I wish they'd stop making noise upstairs, right? The third one is, I love this one. I love the sloth and torpor, or sleepiness, right? The fourth is restlessness. It could be mental restlessness, physical restlessness. And the fifth is doubt, which is actually the most difficult one to get rid of if it really has a hold of you. It's the most dangerous one. We're not going to really establish deep concentration as long as they're there. And I have a personal experience with this. I was on this 10-day retreat, Spence was there, this last, I think it was May, with Lee Brazington. And I was trying to sit on the cushion because I had this idea in my mind, if I was a real meditator, I'm going to be on a zafu, not in a chair, right? Now, it didn't seem to, I didn't seem to notice that both the teachers that were at the two retreats that I'd been to recently sat in chairs, but I was really stubborn, but I was having pain. So I had a one-on-one with Lee, and he said, you know, how's it going? I said, well, you know, da-da-da-da, and this and that, and I said, I'm having some problems with, you know, sitting on the cushion. My hip's bothering me. He says, well, why don't you sit in a chair? Okay, I came back, sat in the chair. The very first sit, I got excess concentration, like, deep. Now, when that happens, thoughts are still there, but the way Lee describes them is they're very wispy and they're in the background. And there's no real emotion attached to it. So if a thought arises, why is that person making so much noise? It's just, I may hear the noise, but I may think that they're moving, but I don't have any energy around it. And if I hear a sound, I don't really attach a story to the sound. It's just a sound. Now, this excess concentration is not something that's unique to the jhanas. I want to make that clear. It happens in both practices. But it is a stage where the hindrances drop away. And what happened is when I was physically comfortable and I didn't have aversion, the second hindrance, I went right into the jhanas. Right into them. Everything else was ready. I just needed to take that one step and alleviate that hindrance. Here's something that Lee said. He said, jhanas are a useful tool for those who can do them. They lead to a state of mind useful for investigation of things as they are. But insight, which is, the investigation is the insight practice, right? But he said, insight practice must be done immediately after leaving the jhanic state, or the jhanas are a waste of time. Yeah. What he's saying is that jhanas are a very useful tool for people that use them. They lead to a great state of mind for investigating how things are, in other words, doing insight practices. But if you're not going into the insight practice right away when you're in that jhana state, that point, single-pointed, deep meditative absorption, there's no point in doing the jhanas. The jhanas are not an end in themselves. And if they are, you're in trouble. Because you're not doing the practice the way it was designed to do. And you can actually get hooked on the jhanas. Because I got to tell you, it feels really good when you're in that state. You know? Okay, briefly, about insight practices. There are a couple different ways to do them if people get into the jhanas. And one is different types of meditations. You can meditate on different things. There's one called the 9 charnel ground contemplations. You're basically thinking about how the body's disintegrating. And that's a great one to do if you have what's called a Vipassana romance. This seems to happen. Hasn't happened to me, but seriously. But you know, it's like there's somebody sitting there, and before the retreat's over, you know, I mean, maybe the second day of the retreat, you've already got it figured out. You're married, you got kids, you know. Well, just do the charnel down ground contemplations and imagine what their body's going to be after a few days of decompensation, and that might you might let go of that attachment. Mindfulness of physical activities, parts of the body. There's a one called sweeping or body scan, and so on. There's also specific contemplations where you contemplate different aspects of things, like the 4 elements, which are solidity, water, air, and heat. And you can contemplate that in your own body and everything that exists and start understanding the nature of how things are. You can contemplate the hindrances. You can contemplate what are called the aggregates, the senses and their objects. There are something called the 7 factors of enlightenment, which we might be studying at some point soon. You can contemplate the 4 noble truths and the nature of suffering. So these are all, and again, we're not getting into these things tonight. I just want, if people say, well, what do you mean you do insight practices when you're in the jhana states? These are just some ideas on the kind of things you can do. Yes, of course.
You don't do the insight practices in the jhana states, just after.
After the jhana states. Once you reach that deep state of concentration, you choose to move into the jhanas. Thank you, if that wasn't clear.
No, you move into the contemplation.
What, did I say it backwards?
You said it backwards. Yeah. You got it backwards.
You move into the contemplation practices after being in the jhanas. That's the point of going into the jhanas, so that you can then move into the insight practices. And I was going to say this later, but I'll say it right now. And this is one of the reasons that the jhanas aren't being practiced a lot and aren't being taught a lot. You need to do a lot of sitting practice to do this. In fact, Aya Kema, who was a jhana master and who was Lee's teacher, she recommended you do 2 hours of practice a day, an hour in the morning and an hour at night, and spend half of that, the first half on jhanas, and the second half on insight practices in both those sets. And I've got something I'll read later that Lee says, you know, you really need to probably get instructed in a long retreat, one-on-one with a teacher. Okay. Since the time of the Buddha, attitudes towards the jhanas have really varied. And there is evidence that in the suttas they were taught at least 2 schools of thought, right? One of them is the jhanas, the other is the moment-to-moment concentration. Let's talk about how the other school has really taken root in this country, because the truth is, it's really hard to get jhana instruction and do jhana retreats in this country. Overwhelmingly, the type of practice that's instructed is moment-to-moment concentration and insight practice. And that is because the predominant teachers, most of them come from teachers in Burma, especially mostly Burma, but other places too, that really stress that. And I want to mention Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw, who is a really important figure in this. And he was born early in the last century, and right after the war, the Prime Minister of Burma asked him to start teaching meditation to lay people. Now, this is a big change. You have to understand that Buddhism was a monastic tradition, and when the teachers were teaching it, they were teaching it to monks. Monks got lots of time to sit and do meditation. Plus, every year there's a rainy season, and they have a 3-month rain retreat or something like that. They call it the rain retreat. 3 months of intense practice. Great for doing jhanas. But what about the people who are coming in once a week and want to learn meditation, or maybe even just once a day and they're going to sit for a little while? maybe not the best candidates for this type of practice. So what Mahasi Sayadaw did is he really emphasized moment-to-moment concentration. And by 1972, he had already instructed over 700,000 meditators. In 79, he came to the West and he held retreats at the newly founded Centers of Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. Well, guess who the founders were of Insight Meditation Society? Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, and Sharon Salzberg. Well, Sharon and Joseph and Jack, Sharon and Joseph studied extensively with Mahasi Sayadaw. So guess what they learned? Also, Rodney Smith was very instrumental. Rodney Smith studied extensively with Mahasi Sayadaw, and he's been a very prominent teacher in this country. And Jan Kornfield studied in Thailand, primarily with Achin Chan, but he also had exposure to those teachings. So this is what Mahasi Sayadaw said. It is possible to begin straight away with insight meditation without having previously developed full concentration in the jhanas. He said, you don't need to do the jhanas to develop insight. And he gave very specific instructions on how to do that. And one of the things that he really stressed, well, two things. One is focusing on the abdomen in the breath as opposed to maybe the nose. And the other thing is noting, a heavy noting practice. Noting is when your thought arises, you label it before you let it go. A successor to Mahasi Sayadaw was currently 91-year-old Sayadaw U, is it U or U? Pandita. U Pandita. He's also Burmese. He became a leading teacher of this. He has taught at Insight Meditation Society. Many of the senior Western meditation teachers have studied with U Pandita. Very important role in this. Achin Chan in Thailand, he taught both the jhanas and the moment-to-moment concentration. But with Western students, he primarily focused on moment-to-moment concentration. And the way I understood it, is that he felt that the Westerners just didn't have it, have the right capacity to develop the deep concentration for the jhanas. Got another way? Let's teach them that. Yeah, I didn't know, no caves, you know. In this particular meditation practice, the moment to moment, the meditator really just lets certain objects arise and lets them pass away, keeping the mind fixed as things arise, just keeping them fixed on one thing exclusively. And although concentration is needed for Vipassana, it's considered momentary. Because you're allowing, I'm not doing a very good job of describing this. I'm going to let somebody else do it. Or do you want to give like a 1 minute synopsis on it?
This is your mind. It's watching this point. This is experience. Experience is going by, and you just keep watching that one point. Right? So it's changing as it's going by, but you're still looking at that one point. Whether it's your breath or your thought or an emotion, whatever's coming up, they float on past. So they rise and pass away, and they rise and pass away.
Well, this is a good commercial for Sunday's class, isn't it? We'll talk about that later. I have been to retreats with two different teachers doing this practice, and I haven't had a lot of success. I went to a jhana retreat, and when I came back, people were telling me, what's different about you? Some people are suited to one more than another. Jhana works for me. I haven't had as much success with the other. That's why I can't describe it very well. I'm going to start moving towards a close because I can see that I want to allow plenty of time for discussion. The arguments, these are the arguments against jhana. I hate to use the word arguments, but these are some of the things that are being said, why the moment-to-moment or concentration is being used. And here they refer to it as bare insight. This is from a group called the Vipassana Dura Meditation Society. Anybody ever heard of them? They say, another advantage to practicing... Oh, let me back up. We have to face the fact that in this hectic and noisy age of ours, the natural quietude of mind, the capacity for higher degrees of concentration, and the requisite external conditions to cultivate both have greatly decreased compared with the days of old. This not only holds for the West, but also to a lesser degree for the East. The principal conditions required for cultivating the absorptions, the jhanas, are seclusion and noiselessness. These are very rare commodities nowadays. In addition, environment and education have produced an increasing number of those types who will naturally be more attracted to and adapted to the direct or bare form of insight. Another thing they say is, another advantage to practicing bare insight rather than attaining jhana first is that the calmness of jhana is said to be so pleasurable as to become addictive for some people. And even Lee, the teacher, he said he's met people who were jhana junkies. They get into the jhanas, they get hooked on this good feeling, and they don't move on to the insight practice, and they just stay there. Might as well smoke pot. I mean, I'm being facetious, but you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's just, it's like meditation candy or something, right? A jhana attainer may remain attached to the bliss and calm of the jhanas and fail to take up insight meditation. Lee Brazenton says, okay, I'll back up a little bit. Here's another teacher. Achan Jumian says, most often students start with insight practices. Sometimes, though, I will teach a concentration or jhana practice first, especially if they've had past meditation experience or if their minds tend towards concentration easily. But in either case, it's most important that everybody does insight practice. And Lee Brazenton says, Theravadan Buddhism, which is what we practice in the West, has primarily come down from the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition in Burma. And this tradition is the dry insight or non-jhanic tradition. Thus, the jhanas are seldom mentioned, let alone taught, in the West. The jhanas are difficult to teach. Not everyone has the temperament suited to it. You really need one-on-one immediate feedback. So, let me just summarize one thing. Both practices have in common that it's absolutely critical to establish an ethical practice. That's why if you look at the Eightfold Path, it's threefold. It is, two of the Eightfold Path relate to sila, to ethics. Three of them have to do with concentration, and three of them have to do with insight. They all work together. You're not going to have success at insight unless you establish the ethical practice first and then build concentration on top of that. In both cases, it's very critical to overcome the hindrances. You can easily find teachings about how to work with each hindrance and overcome them or suppress them. And the point of both of them is to develop insight. Find out which one works best for you, gravitate towards that. We're very lucky. We've got Southern Dharma Retreat Center, about an hour and 15 minutes up here. There are wonderful retreats out there that you can do from a wide variety of highly skilled teachers. We've got a Sangha here. We've got a lot of resources to use.